Hey, my name is Zach. I'm the lead pastor here at Restore. And at our church, we talk a lot about wanting to be a part of restoring faith in Jesus and the church. So we want you to know, wherever you find yourself on your spiritual journey, whether you're deconstructing or reconstructing, whether you're disentangling, doubting, rebuilding, no matter where you are, we want you to know that you are not alone. And we want to be a support for you as you journey down this road of faith. So if you have questions or you need support, we would love to chat with you. You can reach out to us through our website at restoreaustin.org, and we hope you enjoy this week's message.
Hello, hello. It's nice to see everyone here this morning. How are you guys feeling? Awesome. So just to give you guys a little bit of a background about me, I'm Charles. I'm one of the leaders here at Restore. My wife and I have been here since 2019, right before COVID. And we were church hopping for a while. We found Restore, we got here, got plugged in, we loved it. And we were like, okay, this is our church. And then COVID hit, we had to go home. It was a really, really weird time for, I'm sure, a lot of you guys as well. But we were plugged into a small group with good friends of ours now, John, Robin, and Catherine Stewart. And that just kept us fed, and that kept us kind of plugged into the church and the community. And we've been here since. I will say one thing before I start here this morning. I'm not a speaker, so I'm a writer. And so when Zach asked me a few months ago about, hey, we need some help with summer mixtape, my thought was, okay, I've been here for a few years. Summer mixtape is usually kind of a one-on-one interview. I'm a writer, I've done interviews. This is no sweat, Zach, I'll do it. A couple weeks later, one of the leaders was like, hey, man, I'm super excited to hear you speak. And I was like, oh God. But I didn't ask any questions. Huge, huge problem for me. A couple of weeks later, Mark Jordan actually is like, hey, I'm so excited to hear your sermon, Charles. Again, panic set in. Again, no questions were asked. And this is just a good reminder to you guys, always ask questions before you dive into something head first, even if you're trying to be helpful. But all that to say, I'm super pumped to be here. Have you guys, really quick to keep it light early on here, quick show of hands. Are you guys familiar with the game Jenga? Yeah, figured you guys were. We were in Seattle a couple weeks ago, hanging out with family and friends, and we were playing Jenga, and one of our friends' kids was with us. She was young, and every time I play Jenga, I'm reminded how easy the game is. Everyone can play. It's fun for all ages, and the premise of the game is simple, as you guys know, but you start with a rectangular tower of, blocks stacked together. Every player takes a turn, takes a block out of the tower, and then stacks it on top. And as the game goes on, the tower gets taller, and you start seeing these like uneven, uncomfortable spaces in the tower, which makes the game interesting. And at some point, somebody messes up inevitably, and the tower comes tumbling down, right? And the game is fun because what you start with isn't what you end up with. It starts secure, and you end up with chaos. By around like move 10, you realize that like your entire group is devolved into like Lord of the Flies, and it's utter chaos and madness, and everything just becomes panic, right? The reason why I'm talking about Jenga on a Sunday morning, which is totally random, is because Jenga is a game of like one move at a time. It's one decision at a time. And each decision has these like massive ramifications for everything. Everyone takes turns taking either one good move, which can keep the game going, or one bad move, which immediately brings the game to a halt. All it takes is one. If I had to give my message or sermon, whatever you want to call it today, a title, it would be All It Takes Is One. And in the context of Jenga, it's one move, one decision. But I really want us, by the end of this, to be inspired to think of us and this idea of All It Takes Is One as a kind of a charge. Like, what if you can be the one person who can live life in a way that impacts that person next to you, even when you don't expect to, right? All it takes is one. There's a domino effect idea of all it takes is one, and it shows up in a lot of the cliches we all grow up hearing. You've probably heard some of the negative connotation phrases, like one too many or one false step. A chain is only as good as its weakest link. It's similar to the idea. One of my personal favorites, the idea of too many cooks spoil the broth, the idea of it's fine as it is, but if you introduce one new variable, it'll mess up the equilibrium, that kind of idea. On the flip side, though, one too many can also be a good thing. Be the change you want to see in the world, Gandhi's famous quote. There's also my childhood hero, Fred Rogers. He had this really amazing quote. When I was a boy and I would see scary things in the news, my mother would say to me, look for the helpers. You will always find people who are helping. And I think the point of all this that I'm trying to make here with this phrase, it only takes one, you can either be on the wrong side or the right side of things. Every decision we make can land us on either end. And my charge to you guys this morning is, as I kind of dive in here a little bit, is how will you show up this morning? And outside of church, individually, as a family, collectively, as a church group. And I want you to like sit with that, this question of identity, who you're going to be. I want you to sit with that as I kind of unpack my past, my childhood, where I came from, and you know why I'm here today. It's a very jagged journey, as I'm sure a lot of you guys have also had. So I'm going to share a little bit of that with you guys this morning. I grew up in New York, the boogie down Bronx. And my wife likes to make fun of me because I don't speak like I grew up in the Bronx anymore. At some point along the way, especially around college, I lost a lot of the New York affectations and the accent and stuff like that. So, for example, I say the word coffee now like a normal person. But when I was a kid, I think I said coffee or whatever it is. I can't even say it now because it's super embarrassing. But my relationship with God and church and like who I am today, it all is rooted in the Bronx. I grew up in a Christian home. My parents were super religious. My family was all really religious. And I am not exaggerating when I tell you guys, I was in church like 3, 4, 5 times a week. I wasn't a pastor's kid, but it always felt like it. There were always meetings of some sort to go to. And Sunday services for us weren't like 90-minute affairs. They weren't just worship, word, go home. They were like 4 or 5 hours. Service started at 8 a.m. It was like a whole thing. So that was like my life growing up for, you know, up until college pretty much. And as a kid, though, amidst all the pomp and circumstance of all this church stuff, I felt as a kid something was amiss, and I just couldn't put my finger on it. And to give you context into that, when I was young, I read a lot, and I was really precocious, and my teachers saw that. I was one of those kids. Every class has that kid who's like really smart, knows all the answers. I was that dude when I was a kid. And I have this really funny thing to show you guys. I hope we have the image here. If not, I'll read it to you anyway. But in second or third grade, our teacher made us all do a project. She was trying to teach us the idea of stories. And so like the beginning, middle, end kind of framework. And the assignment was we each had to go home, write an original story, and we would bring it back to class and we would read it out loud. And then at the end, we would all decorate it and then hang it up outside. Simple project. All I had to do was write a story, all right? So everyone came to class with their little stories, and I came to class with a poem. Is it up there? Oh God, okay, amazing. All right, so this is me at 7 years old, just to kind of give you guys a glimpse into like the madness of Charles, right? I wrote a poem called Thoughts of an Orphan. I'm gonna read it really quickly. And my handwriting is still gibberish like this even today. Leaves live with trees, squirrels live with acorns, fish live with water, birds live with the air, but I live alone. Lions live in the jungle, dolphins live in the water, zebras live in the wild, eagles live with the wind while I live alone. And I thought the but and the while at the end, those two lines, was really cool and smooth. That was me as like a 7-year-old, right? My teacher saw this and immediately her initial reaction was, oh my God, this is amazing. She was really pleasantly surprised. But then I saw like a look of horror in her face, and I was 7, so I didn't really catch why, but she did call my parents over to school. And so you see where I'm going with this. So they were discussing my poem, and I've never seen my mom more pale than she was that day. Basically, my teacher, the school thought this is a cry for help. There's something wrong in the Samuel household. We need to check on this kid. We got to make sure things are okay. My mom was like, whatever you're doing, Charles, please tell them you're okay. And I was okay. I told everyone we were fine. I was just a normal kid putting myself in the shoes of an orphan and writing poetry. It was just whatever, right? I was just deep. That was my thing. And the reason why, this is a silly poem, obviously, but the reason why I bring this up is not just because it's funny, but I also want to kind of show you guys that as a kid, I was really observing things, not just in like the stuff that I was learning in school or reading in books or, you know, watching on TV or whatever, but I was also really noticing stuff that was happening in church. And being a kid that was in Sunday school and learning stuff about Jesus, and how good he was and how much he cared about people, there's something that didn't align with like how my church was like functioning, and I'll kind of unpack that a little bit more. To tell you guys about my specific Indian church upbringing, I'm going to give you guys a quick truncated history lesson, and it's not going to be perfect. There's a lot of amazing sources on this stuff in academia and amazing like documentaries and stuff on this. But I want to talk about the Asian American immigrant experience, especially the church experience from like the 50s in America through like the 90s. And again, this is really truncated, and I know, you know, no ethnic group is a monolith. And so what I'm going to share is just based on data. I'm not going to speak on behalf of all Indian people, but this is definitely stuff that I saw for myself. That period, the 50s to the 90s, was a period where there were a lot of folks coming from East Asia, Southeast Asia, and South Asia, especially for like health visas and like just healthcare jobs, and they brought their spouses. Those people who came first are called first generation immigrants, okay? Their kids, folks like me, I was born in New York, two immigrants. My parents came in the 70s and 80s. I'm considered a second generation immigrant. My wife is as well. So first generation, second generation. And this is true still to this day about a lot of immigrants, but oftentimes what you find with immigrants, especially in the first generation, they were well-educated at home, but when they got to America, they couldn't necessarily work in their specialties right away, unless they were credentialed up. So they would have to either pay up to, you know, take the tests and go back to school and do some stuff. In some cases, like, they didn't have the option. They came to America to work and provide for their family, so they didn't have an option but to pivot. So a lot of doctors in India, for example, were trained to be doctors in India. They come to America and they can pay money and spend time to become a doctor here, or pivot and do something else. I know plenty of stories of like bus drivers who were doctors in India and things like that. My dad was an accountant in India when he came in the 70s. He couldn't be an accountant here, so he had to pivot. So because a lot of immigrants, first gen especially, they can't immediately come out here guns blazing and, you know, kind of like, you know, carving out their own path from day one, what they need more than anything else is friends. They need community. They need like a support system. And so what you find is that a lot of immigrants, first gen especially, they kind of hole up together in these enclaves and cities. It's the reason why in a lot of big cities you'll find pockets like Koreatown or like the famous, you know, Little Italy in the Bronx near where I grew up, right? A lot of that is because if there's a shared language, there's a shared foods, shared entertainments. And so especially for first gen, that's a sense of safety. Another thing that pops up in those communities are churches, especially ethnic-specific churches, which are specifically catered to that first gen. So I grew up in a church like that, where we spoke that, our my parents' language primarily. My mom and my sisters, they dressed in like saris and salwar kameezes and like the typical things you would expect in India. So it was very, very just like ethnic-specific, tied to the culture, things like that. And so in some ways, churches and these immigrants thrive together. So the church attracts people. These immigrants join the church. There's a diffusion of skills and interests and passions. The church grows. It attracts more people, so on and so forth, right? So there's this sort of like symbiotic relationship in these communities where churches are thriving and their people are thriving in some way. But there's also, and this is where my story comes in, and a lot of stories I learned as I became an adult, come in, when those churches are not led well, when those churches have, you know, poor leadership at the reins, there's this sort of toxicity that's brewing underneath. Because what happens in those early first-gen communities is that obviously first, there's this insane personal loyalty to country. They just came from there. That's home. They're pining for home in this new land. So there's this loyalty to country that comes up. But as this community gets found in church, there's also this loyalty to church. And so as the church grows, the loyalty to country continues to increase, loyalty to church, patriotism, church. And here in 2023 America, we kind of have context into the problems of that, right? When you conflate state and church and all the issues that arise with like unfettered, unchecked, off the rails, kind of American evangelicalism, kind of, that's like the case study for most of us now. But in a lot of these immigrant communities, that's what ends up happening. There's a lot of like under the surface bubbling up of this toxicity. A lot has been written about the Korean American church in particular. There's a lot of really fantastic data about it. There's a really great article in the New York Times in 1977. The article is called "Korean Churches Provide an Introduction to America." And in that article, it's a really beautiful profile on like the early Korean American experience in America. But also like the boom of the church and what the expectation was for those communities, those pockets of people, but also the churches. And so yearly growth was expected. First generation folks were gonna have kids. Second generation folks were gonna have kids, so on and so forth. So that growth was just expected. But in the 90s, something really weird happened. The data showed that those churches were starting to plateau in growth. And at some point, early 90s, there was a precipitous drop in growth. And that was really, really baffling for a lot of people. And if you think about it, the first gen, we talked about like the security in familiarity, right? There was an absolute crazy need for these ethnic specific churches. But for kids like me who grew up in America, went to school, English was my second language technically, but it quickly became my primary dominant language. You know, I was as comfortable outside of my Indian skin as I was in my Indian skin, right? So at some point, the second generation didn't necessarily need those churches as much, especially when we started seeing the toxicity brewing underneath and how dangerous it was to conflate those two things, church and country, right? So second generation in the 80s and the 90s, they just started leaving and droves. In academia, and the history lesson's almost over after this, in academia, this exodus has been called, is dubbed the silent exodus. There's a seminal article in Christianity Today in 1996, writer Helen Lee, she coined the phrase, the article is called silent exodus, and she looks at the data and she presents reasons for why this is happening, right? We were expecting this growth, folks are leaving, especially second gen, and she had all these reasons, and in the 25 years since, there's been a lot of literature on this. And one of the major reasons for why people were leaving was because we noticed that our ethnic-specific churches were intentionally insular and closed off from the communities and the neighborhoods they were in. And so initially, that's not so bad. First gen, 50s, 60s, 70s, that's important. You have to kind of protect who you have, and that's fine. But as kids like me grew up in America and we have friends who are not Indian, well, we start thinking about things and like what church should be, especially when we start reading about Jesus and learning about Jesus and who he was. So, and those churches aren't closed off for nefarious reasons. They just happen to be for culture. But in those environments, you're prioritizing culture and, you know, traditions and heritage, and propping that up at the expense of like what the second generation needs, at the expense of your community, your non-Indian or non-ethnic specific community. And my church in particular, we weren't like outright kicking people out if they didn't look like us, but we weren't making them feel welcome either. I went to church in Jamaica, Queens. So if you're familiar with Jamaica, or you know, you're a fan of 50 Cent and you've heard his music, you know Jamaica, Queens is kind of a hotbed of culture in New York, one of the most heterogeneous places in all of the country. Literally, you drive 5 minutes down Hillside Avenue down there, and it's the Indian diaspora and the, you know, Korean diaspora and something from South America and Central America and all these different amazing groups of people within like 5 minutes of driving. That's Jamaica, Queens. My church was smack dab in the middle of that community. So as I grew up in the 90s, and this, I didn't know this at the time, but in this silent exodus period of Asian American minorities and the second generation bouncing, I was living this period where we were in Jamaica. We have all these people around us that we should be talking to, we should be loving, and we're not doing anything about it. What's going on here? And again, as a kid that wrote that orphan poem, I was really baffled about all this asymmetry that I was finding. But in the 90s, the zeitgeist was changing, and I think I wasn't alone. My experience wasn't unique at all. There were a lot of other folks, obviously with the data, that were leaving. But during that time, as I was growing up until college, I was kind of like the rabble-rouser at church. I was making my Sunday school teachers annoyed because I was going to ask questions. I was going to ruffle feathers. And again, I read a lot, so it wasn't just like the Bible. I was reading like concordances and like all these other things, references and all these things that would like challenge me. So I was challenging people. And a lot of my Sunday school teachers hated me for that or were angry with me. But a few of them allowed me to like stretch and ask questions and sit in that doubt. And they sat in the tension with me. But the church board and the church pastor did not like me much because I would, especially in high school, I was a writer, so I would draft these like letters on behalf of the youth in my church, and I would bring up issues that we were having, and I was always that kid, right? So it was 18 years of this stress and pain and trauma, and when I was ready to apply for colleges, I applied to California, I had a dream school there. I had a dream school in Florida, in Miami, and I wanted to go to Duke. If Zach was here, I'm sure he would give a shout out to Duke. But I wanted to get as far away from this place that I could. I ended up getting a scholarship to Miami, so I went to Miami. So that's the history lesson and kind of like my background. The purpose of this message is all it takes is one, and I'll explain why that is right now. My first few weeks in Miami, I'm getting used to stuff. First time away from home, I had no friends. I literally picked this school because they were really great in the early 2000s for football, and I wanted to be a part of that environment. And also just because it was away from my parents and church. And I didn't want anything to do with church. I wasn't going to go. I had, for you know, all intents and purposes, I had given up on faith, right? And I get an email about like 2 weeks into my Miami career, and it's an email from my pastor from New York. And for whatever reason, I decided to open it. And it was really ugly. Line after line of vicious attacks on my character. And at one point, and I'll never forget this line, because for 11 years after he sent me this email, I would keep this email active in my inbox. And I didn't know it at the time. In the Asian community, we don't talk about mental health much, but I suffered from debilitating depression. And I still do, I'm still recovering, but especially early on, I had no tools, no vocabulary to kind of deal with this stuff. And every few months, I would read this email, just as a reminder, Charles, you're a loser. Charles, you won't amount to anything. This one line in particular always gets to me. My pastor said something like, your soul is a huge void like the potholes in New York, and I hope you never get filled. And that broke me, man. That really broke me. But again, it, you know, I think I would have been justified to send a vicious email, diatribe back, and it took everything in me to not do that. And I was also really tired and exhausted from church. Of thinking of God as this vengeful, ugly looking God, because that's all I'd ever seen growing up, right? 18 years of my life. And then 2 weeks later, here's this email. I remember reading that and I was absolutely heartbroken, but I didn't respond. I just kept it there. And I should have deleted it. I absolutely should have deleted it, but I kept it there. I'm going to fast forward. I was 18 at the time. At some point early on in college, I got acquainted with a church. It was because a friend was nagging me to go, and I went, and I actually really liked it. It was a church where the pastor seemed human, and people were asking questions, and they were okay with that. Everyone was kind of like on this journey together, kind of like what we feel like at Restore sometimes. And that kind of revived me and revived my faith journey. I also studied music and philosophy, and having that philosophy background allowed me to like be comfortable in the tension and ask questions and be okay with like bigger questions afterward, right? So my journey in my 20s was all about deconstruction, reconstruction, asking a lot of questions and being comfortable in this like unknown. That was okay. And as I finished school, I went back to New York. I was a musician. I was a choir director, band leader. I was in a band. We traveled the country, all that stuff. All that stuff was happening. And just because I found God again, I guess, in my 20s, doesn't mean I had it all figured out. My mental health was still an issue. It was something that I didn't know was an issue. And then things cascaded in my late 20s. And I had a really, really, really dark night at 28 or 29. I remember it was an evening, I was sitting at home, I was living with my parents at the time, and just a lot of life stuff happened. It was just a cascading kind of stuff, I guess. And again, I had not reconciled any of my mental health issues, and I didn't even know that I had depression. But that night, I prepared to like end things. So I was sitting at my desk, writing out my notes, or trying to, and I was sobbing. And every time I was sobbing, I had to wipe, and I couldn't keep writing. So I kept reminding myself, man, you're such a loser. You can't even finish this note. And it was just like this vicious cycle that night. And I for whatever reason, it was taking me way longer. I had everything planned out the next morning, what I was going to do. And I remember at some point, I just broke down. I couldn't finish it for whatever reason. I couldn't like continue. And corner of my desk, corner of my eye, my laptop, there's a little alert in the Google, you know, Gmail window, whatever. It was a message that I hadn't checked all day. It was just like kind of an alert. And for whatever reason, I decided to go there and check it. And it was a random friend of mine, a good friend of mine. It wasn't random, but it was a random message. I hadn't talked to him in months. And the message literally just said, hey man, I just wanted to let you know that I'm thinking about you. And there was that email from my pastor that broke me. And this message broke me in a totally different way. And I remember thinking, man, there's one person out there that's thinking about me. I cannot let him down. Then I started thinking about like, wait, there might be other people who also are thinking about me and I don't want to let them down either. And so after some soul searching, I decided to crumple the paper, toss it away, get a good night's sleep, didn't carry out whatever I had planned, right? And that decision for my friend, it was a random thing. Actually, my wife and I met up with him. He didn't know this all happened that night. It was just a random nice message from a friend, right? We all do this sometimes. But my wife and I met up with him and his wife a few years ago, actually. So this is like 7 years later. And I pulled him aside one time and I was like, bro, I don't know if you remember that night, but that was a really dark night. This was going to happen. And I saw your message. Do you remember that? And he was like, I have no idea what you're talking about. But we were crying. It was just like an amazing, powerful moment. Like, you never know what someone's going through. Just check up on them. After that, like, breakdown, I made some really critical life decisions. I moved to DC, switched careers, and started therapy, which is a huge, huge, huge thing. And that was like the impetus for all those things. I knew that's probably not as bad as it could get, and I don't want it to get any worse than that night, right? And so for me, there's a lot of incidental moments throughout my life, and I'm sure all of us have these moments. It might not look like that email that I got that changed my life for a decade after. It might not be like that night when it's the darkest you've ever felt, where a friend reaches out to you, but we all have those moments where it only takes one, right? One person's email, one person's little nice gesture online somewhere. In the Bible, in scripture, it's full of illustrations of all it takes is one. If you look at the Old Testament, you've got Noah and Moses, Joshua, Caleb, Rahab, Esther, David, plenty, right? You can go up and down the list. And they each had a singular moment or decision, but their decisions as the decision makers, it changed the course of history or their people's history, right? And then in the New Testament in particular, and this is where I'll kind of wrap, one story stands out to me in particular, and I love this story. We probably all know it if you've been in church. It's where Jesus talks about the Good Samaritan. And to summarize, it's a story of a Jewish man. He's walking, traveling on a road, and he gets robbed, beaten, and left for dead. And first, a priest walks by, just completely ignores him. Then a religious leader walks by and ignores him and walks on the opposite side of the road. And then finally, a Samaritan man stops to help this injured person. And he doesn't just stop, he bandages the wounds. He carries him to safety, and then he pays for his care. And there's a lot to unpack here about why he's Samaritan, why he's a Jewish person. But long story short, Samaritans and Jewish people, especially at the time, despised each other as enemies. So Jesus was making this point that the Samaritan person looked past all social divides to show compassion. And he made a choice, an active choice, to help rather than walk away like those religious leaders did. Pastor Rich Velotis from New York has this really excellent way to explain this. The Good Samaritan story is not just an example of compassionate spirituality. It is a critique against religious passivity. Jesus is basically saying that if church people won't work for justice and mercy, he'll find some other people who will. And Jesus is using this story to teach that our neighbor isn't just someone from our own group, from our own enclave, from our own hometown. It's not necessarily a person that looks like you or talks like you. It's literally anybody in need. Everybody has a seat at the table, which is something Zach's been kind of telling all of us here every Sunday for a long time now, one of the kind of the ethos of the church. And it's up to us to show mercy and kindness and love like that Samaritan person did. It only takes one voice to change everything. In my life, it was a series of things, but it was those two voices that had those dramatic effects and in some cases, spiraling effects on me, right? It only takes one person to choose compassion over prejudice, one person standing up when everyone else is turning away, and each of us can be that voice. And I think the question for me to you guys today is, will we walk by or will we stop to help in those moments? Will you choose to be kind in those moments when you want to be angry in those moments? If you're going to send an angry email out and make comparisons to the potholes in New York tomorrow morning, please don't. Just hold off on that for a little bit. In some cases, we're the only Jesus other people will ever meet. There's a really great song. I think it's Is it Tony Amos or Tori Amos from the 90s? What if God was one of us, just a slob like one of us? Joan Osborne? Yeah, there it is. Just a stranger on the bus. I should have done some research before that. Trying to make his way home is a beautifully simple song. And it's not exactly what I'm talking about here, but the idea is like, what if you're the only representation of Jesus someone ever gets? Do you want to be the person who sent that email? Or do you want to be the person who's kind and caring and thoughtful, even in dark moments? Rachel Held Evans has this really great quote. The kingdom of heaven is not some far off future dream. It's here among us, made real by the life, death, resurrection of Jesus. So will we be the one to stop and help when no one else will? Are we gonna cross divides to love that supposed enemy in our lives? Are we gonna speak for the voiceless, those people who are underrepresented, not represented at all? And if you think about it, all around us, there's real brokenness everywhere, right? In our cities, in our schools, in our neighborhoods, in our families in some cases, there's real injustice that calls for real action, real suffering that calls for real care. Who's gonna answer that call? My hope this morning is that that light of God is gonna be found here amongst us, among us, inside us, inside all of our hearts. We're all on this journey together. Some of us are deconstructing, some of us are reconstructing, some of us are just kind of feeling it all out, and that's all okay. Because all it takes is one person. All it takes is one moment, one good action, when there was another action to choose. So I want you guys this morning to be that one person who lives life in a way that dramatically changes someone else's life for the better, starting today. Thanks, guys. Now, Matthew.
Hey. Q&A time. All right, buddy. Normally, Ashley has been the one doing questions in this series, but she lost her voice. So I get the honor of grilling.
Amazing.
Discovering with you. So thank you. Thank you for that, man. Thank you also for just being so vulnerable in there. I mean, it means a lot. As someone who has tried to do that myself, it takes a lot. So thank you. I wanted to ask you a few questions. Firstly, just in response to your message, are there any practices or things in your life that have helped you cultivate love and compassion for others?
Yeah, I think listening is really important. You learn that very quickly as a writer who's interviewing people. You listen, wait for pauses, wait for silence, be okay in the silence, and don't talk over people. The people who know me know that I don't talk a lot, but I definitely make moments to listen, and I'm paying attention to everything, because I know that if I catch a detail or I notice something that even someone else is not picking up, I can show that person love and care when they least expect it. So listening to me has always been kind of, especially since like I was 20, that's become a major skill of mine and something I try to take care of.
Listening, that's good. What would you recommend for the church at large to do to embrace immigrants or people on the fringes of society and different cultures better?
That's a great question. I think a lot of churches are grappling with it. Even the big good ones are grappling with that as well. I think it's really important to understand like what I was talking about here, my experience in the ethnic specific church, right? It isn't like an indictment of the character of that church, right? It isn't any of that. There's definitely a place for ethnic specific churches, but also within churches, there's definitely space for ethnic specific practices and other things, so that we know that we're caring for important populations in our community, in our neighborhood, things like that. That's all that's really important. The challenge becomes like, how do we, and this is, I'm leaving it open-ended because I don't have an answer for this. But the challenge always becomes like, how do we balance that with, how do we balance taking care of those people who have really important cultural needs, need to be represented the right way, but also still care about these new people, new faces. And is there a balance? Is there not? I don't have an answer for that. I think I'm learning in academic circles that it's not easy to answer.
Sure. Yeah. And I mean, it's like you mentioned, it's very specific to
yep.
every group, every community. Right.
Right.
something that we all make together. Yeah, we all build together as one body. That's good. I wanted to ask you too. What's your like your favorite topic to write about?
Topic to write about? Yeah. Oh man. That's a great question. My wife makes fun of me because when I write, I'm very snarky and mean.
Oh, fun.
I come off as a totally different person. I write a lot about politics. I was in DC, I was a political writer. And so politics and faith and culture, that intersection, it's very messy. And it's really fun talking about the messiness of that. So the last like 6 years with like the post-Trump era, especially, a lot of fun unpacking things and just discussing.
Fun, real fun.
A lot of fun for a writer and content creator. I really like talking about that, like the messiness of the, and the tension and kind of trying to make sense of it for myself. And hopefully that makes sense for other people too.
Yeah, that's good. Where can people read your writings?
I have a blog. Yeah, it's just myname.com. My wife is also a great writer, and she talks about stuff like this as well. And we have this lens where we're talking about it from like what we grew up with, right, in our community. And our lens is very specific. And so, it's something that I try to cultivate and keep going.
Very cool. Yeah. Love that. What's your favorite thing about Restore?
There's two things actually. So when Rachel and I were looking up churches, we were church hopping for a while when we got here, and we were actually looking up organizations, like nonprofit organizations to like work with in Austin. And that's where we actually came across Restore. It was the Restore partnership page.
It's like Habitat for Humanity.
Yeah, it was like random.
The
was like
Restore. Random. We get calls all the time for the Restore.
Really?
Do you have a toilet? Do you have toilets? No.
Seriously. You know, it was great SEO from Restore, and like we got it. And then, so that's the first thing. The second thing, we met with Zach for the first time when we first joined, and we asked him, you know, we both come from very like traumatic church backgrounds, and we asked him a lot of tough questions. He had no good answers.
Ooh. There it goes. Here, you want this?
Sure. Sorry about that, guys. We asked him really tough questions, and he did not have any good answers for us. And that, I think, was endearing, but also kind of, we knew that, like, he was on this journey with us, and that was very interesting to hear, and we wanted to learn more, and so we're here. Yeah.
Cool. Awesome. Well, thank you, Charles. We appreciate you, man. Glad you're on the leadership team, and you're, yeah. You're good. We'll have to replace it. It's fine. It's fine. No, I'm just kidding. It's actually somebody broke it like 2 weeks ago. So yeah. Thanks, bud. Great. What's that? Week four? That down? Yeah. Awesome. Summer mixtape. Well, thank you guys for being here. I'm so glad you're part of the community and here with us. We've got Ashley coming up next week. Hopefully her voice is back. We'll see. Yeah. If not, I'm doing part two of mine and it's gonna get dark. Kidding. I'm really glad you're laughing at that. Love you guys very much. It's great to see you, and hope to see you next week. Y'all take care.